Before I read, we're going to look at chapters 1 to 4 tonight. Neil is going to look at chapters, probably he's going to summarize 1 to 4, but he'll also be looking at chapters 5 and 6 next week, and particularly looking at the response of Esther to the dilemma, the denouement that is described for us in these opening four chapters. But before I read, and I'm going to read chapters 3 and 4 in a moment, but we need some background, and we need a history lesson. At least some of us need a history lesson, and some of you know this period of history, perhaps in the 5th century BC, extremely well, but we need to go back a little further than that. You'll all know, of course, 721 BC is an important date, the downfall, destruction of the northern city of Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel. It fell to the Assyrian invasion and Ashurbanipal and Sargon II, some of you might know these great kings of the Assyrian Empire, but the northern kingdom fell in 721 BC. Then you move down the historical corridor about 120 years or so, focusing now on the southern kingdom of Judah and Jerusalem. And by this time, the Babylonians have conquered the Assyrians, and the Babylonians have now become dominant in world history and politics of that period. And from about 605 to 586 BC, over that 18-year or so, 17-18-year period of history, there were successive waves of attack on Jerusalem, in which the Babylonians would capture and send into exile certain Jewish leaders. And by 586 BC, Jerusalem would finally fall, and the last king of Judah would be taken into captivity in Babylon. The last thing that would happen is that his eyes would be taken from him. He'd be blinded, just as he saw his two sons murdered. That was the last thing he would see. And he was taken blinded in chains into Babylon, and we don't know what happened to him after that. That was the end of, effectively, Israel. Whether it's the northern kingdom or the southern kingdom, and it would not know an historical existence until 1946, 1947, when the nation of Israel would once again emerge in world history and politics. They would be in captivity. If you measure it from 605, when the first wave of attack on Jerusalem, they'd be in captivity for 70 years, until 539 BC, October the 12th, on 539 BC, the army of the Persians, the great Cyrus the Great, Cyrus the Second, the Achaemenids, whose lands bordered with Babylon to the north and east of Babylon. And you'll remember from your history, perhaps, in 539, the armies, the Persian army, waded through the Euphrates River and up through the canal system of the ancient city of Babylon and conquered the Babylonians, and effectively Babylon, the kingdom of Babylon, the empire of Babylon, including Israel and Judah, of course, then became under the rule and dominion of the Persians. You'll remember, of course, from Daniel chapter 5. And Herodotus, the famous Greek historian, writing as a contemporary historian, describes that Belshazzar, the king, the Babylonian king, was having one of his drunken parties, and the handwriting on the wall, if you don't remember Daniel 5, you'll remember perhaps Walton's Belshazzar's Feast, some of you, and the story of how the Persians overthrew the mighty kingdom of Babylon. And thus began the Persian Empire in 539 BC and its world dominance. It covered an area from Pakistan. We were praying for Pakistan tonight. At this point, Pakistan is under the rule of the Persians. It went as far west as the islands of Greece. Now, the Persians were never able to conquer Greece. In the event that we're going to be looking at, the story of Esther, about 3 or 4 years into the future from, say, chapter 4, the king, the Persian king, Xerxes, will attempt to conquer Greece. And some of you will remember the very famous Battle of Thermopylae. And the Greek king, Leonidas, and the Spartans took the battle to the Persians at the famous Battle of Thermopylae. And in 480 BC, many historians, Cutledge, a famous Greek scholar in Cambridge University, written a famous volume on the Battle of Thermopylae, written a famous volume on Alexander the Great from the next century, would regard that battle as a battle of historic world importance. The future of Europe and the constitution of Europe would be forever changed because the Persians failed to conquer Greece. It is the Xerxes of the Book of Esther that is involved in that famous battle of Thermopylae. Now, Cyrus, you remember, if we go back to 539 BC, when the Persians conquered the Babylonians by wading up the Euphrates River and the canal system of Babylon, Cyrus, you remember, issued a decree that the Jews and indeed other exiles in Babylon should return. We may think Cyrus a good king. I don't know what his motives were. They were probably financial and political rather than any great love for the Jews. He was fulfilling prophecy, as Isaiah the prophet had predicted and prophesied, that one Cyrus would issue a decree for the Jews to return. That return would begin with Zerubbabel in 520 BC would come Ezra, and the first 4 chapters of the book of Ezra and the rebuilding of the temple. That temple would be eventually finished by 516 BC. And then some 60 years later would come the return of Nehemiah and the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. Now, I haven't lost you. There's a lot of history in a very short space of time. The book of Esther falls between the return of Ezra and the return of Nehemiah. Nehemiah is still future as we're reading this story. So none of these events take place in Jerusalem, of course, which is the focus of Ezra and Nehemiah. The focus of the book of Esther is another city entirely, not Babylon, but the city of Susa. Now, What we need to think about is that when Ezra returned, well, Zerubbabel returned, Ezra returned, and eventually Nehemiah will return, many of the Jews did not return. They didn't want to return. We might have the misconception that when Cyrus issued the decree that all the Jews could return to Jerusalem, that they all went, but actually a very small proportion of them, a minority of them returned. The vast majority of Jews remained in Babylon because they had it good. Then, as now, they were successful businessmen. They made a good living for themselves. They didn't want to return. And that's an interesting question. Why didn't they return to Jerusalem? And there may be good motives and there may be not so good motives. But among those who did not return are the characters like Mordecai the Jew and his cousin Esther in this book that we're looking at. They were among Jews who did not return. By all accounts, Mordecai and Esther, of course, would have been born in Susa. They would have been Babylonians. Mordecai had a Babylonian name, Marduk, who was a Babylonian god. So he had a Babylonian name. But what is interesting, and I think Neil may well be touching on this next week, is that despite the fact that he was born in Babylon, despite the fact that he had a Babylonian name, he was a believer. How strong a believer, I'll let Neil tell you next week, perhaps. So we're in between that period, between Ezra's return and the rebuilding of the temple, but before Nehemiah's return and the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem, when many of the Jews are still in Babylon and, for some of them, enjoying the good life. Now, elsewhere in the world, you have just at this time of the book of Esther, 480, 2, 3, 4, 5 BC, somewhere around there, 5th century BC, you've got Pericles in Greece, forming the beginnings of what we would call today democracy in Athens. And you've got Sophocles, the playwright who wrote Oedipus Rex and Electra. You've got Aristotle and Protagoras, some of the great philosophers of all time. You've got Socrates, whom the early church fathers of the 2nd and 3rd century AD actually respected a great deal. And elsewhere in the world, you've got Confucius. The so-called sayings of Confucius in China, this is the 5th century BC. We are in Susa. Susa is in what we would call today Iran, or what you would call Iran. Isn't it fascinating? You know, this is a story that's set in Iran, in Susa. And the king is, he's given a Persian name, Ahasuerus. Look at Esther chapter 1 and verse 1. That was giving you a long time to find the book of Esther, if you didn't know where to find it in the Old Testament, coming as it does just for the book of Job. Ahasuerus, as he's called, that's his Persian name. His Greek name is Xerxes. And his father is Darius the Mede, did you read about in the book of Daniel. His grandfather is Cyrus the Great, who issued the decree way back in 539 BC. And his son is going to be Artaxerxes, to whom Nehemiah is going to be a cupbearer. Right? So those are all the connections. So let's pick up the story. Chapter 1 is about a story about Queen Vashti. This is Xerxes, or Ahasuerus' wife, who's summoned to the king. She is probably going to have to do one of these dances like Salome had to do, and she refuses. You know, she has a hissy fit and says no, and you just didn't say no to a Persian king. And so she is told, she's banished, she's divorced, she's no longer going to be the queen, she's never going to be brought into his presence ever again. That's chapter 1. Queen Vashti appears and disappears. Chapter 2 is about Esther, and how Esther, for an entire year in a harem in Hebrew. I don't have to explain to you what that is, right? She's not just a nobody. It's worse than that. She's in a harem. And for a whole year, she is preened and beautified and skin ointments and oils and ablutions and everything else to make her look as stunning and beautiful as is possible, all in order that she might become the queen, the next queen, the next wife of this king, Xerxes. That's chapter 2. Now let's pick up chapter 3. And here we pick it up because Mordecai, who is Esther's, their cousins, Mordecai has overheard a plot to assassinate Xerxes. Two of his men, he overhears this plot. So in chapter 3, verse 1, after these things, King Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, promoted Haman, the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. So we've got Haman, who's the prime minister in the government of Xerxes, the king, the Persian king. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And when they spoke to him day after day, and he would not listen to them, they told Haman in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. So here's the denouement. Mordecai refuses to bow to Haman. Whether that is a piece of arrogance on Haman's part, whether you interpret that from a religious point of view, that bowing to him was an act of religious veneration, that as a Jew he couldn't perform, or whether Haman should have been bowed to because you pay homage to those who rule over you, and you pay taxes to Caesar, and so on. Interpreters and commentators are divided on that, and you can take your opinion, and that's what it is. And half the commentators are going to be with you, and half are not going to be with you. But whatever, whether Mordecai was doing it out of religious scruples or whether it was just a personal act of his, the result of it is that Haman is going to kill all of the Jews. It's an ethnic cleansing on the grandest scale. So Haman becomes the Nazi Hitler figure of the 5th century BC to deal with the Jewish question, the Jewish problem, in much the same way as the history of the 1930s, say, in Germany, in Nazi Germany, was an attempt to deal with the Jewish question. He takes his suggestion to the king. The king agrees, unbelievably so, doesn't question the fact, as Haman explains, that all of the Jews throughout the whole land are showing disrespect to the king. That was not true. You know, the vast majority of the Jews were hardworking, trying to make a living, and showing, I think, respect, and were Babylonians to all intents and purposes. So it's astonishing that the king makes no inquiry, no investigation as to whether these words are true or not. He agrees, takes off his signet ring, the deed, the decree to annihilate all of the Jews is signed. It becomes the law of the land. Haman then decides on the 13th day, that the 13th day of the month of Adar, or Adar in Hebrew, which falls somewhere between February and March, will be the day on which this will take place. Now, as a result of all that, a Jewish festival emerges when the Jews are triumphant. The Jewish festival of Purim will emerge on the 14th day of Adar. Next year, 2012, Purim falls on March, and I'm speaking from memory, on March 7th or 8th or somewhere around there. So it's a spring festival. At this festival, by the way, little children, when the whole book of Esther is read, and little children are encouraged when the name of Haman is read, the little children are urged to yell at the top of their voices, "May his name be blotted out forever and ever." So it's one of these great rituals. As the book of Esther is read, all the children begin to yell, "May the name of Haman be blotted out, and may the name of Esther be remembered forever." If you're ever in, if you know some Jewish folk who celebrate Purim, that's something that they do. Now let's pick up chapter 4. When Mordecai learned all that had been done, Mordecai tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city, and he cried out with a loud and bitter cry. He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one was allowed to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. And in every province, wherever the king's command and his decree reached, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's young women and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called for Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs, who had been appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why it was. Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened to him, and the exact sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her and command her to go to the king to beg his favor and plead with him on behalf of her people. And Hathach went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and commanded him to go to Mordecai and say, "All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law: to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter so that he may live. But as for me, I have not been called to come to the king these 30 days. And they told Mordecai what Esther had said. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" and Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf, and do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. Now, that famous verse, verse 14, "Who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews, for if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Now, I only have one point this evening, and my point is simply this: the providence of God. Do you see what Mordecai is saying to Esther? Esther is in this unique position, and her response, Neil will take up next week, but she is the queen. She is also a Jew. It remains to be seen whether Xerxes actually knows of her Jewish lineage to the extent that the book of Esther has revealed to us. She's in a unique position, and Mordecai is urging her as the only one now who can influence him to release this decree of ethnic cleansing, of the annihilation of all of the Jews. You notice what Mordecai says. He says, "Relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place." In other words, if she doesn't do it, their deliverance will come from another place. Now, how does he know that? Only because he knows the promise that God has made with regard to the Jews. A promise in its macro level involves Genesis 3:15, that from the lineage of the Jews will arise a Messiah, a Savior. It is unthinkable to Mordecai that Xerxes' decree will actually succeed, because that would destroy and nullify the promise that God has made. In other words, Mordecai is saying, God is in control here. God is in control of everything. He's in control of Vashti's divorce. He's in control of the year-long elaborate ritual through which Esther went, and the fact that she was chosen to be Xerxes' wife. He is in control. God is in control of the wicked, evil machinations of Haman. Haman is Judas. Haman is Hitler. He's Stalin. He's Pol Pot. He's Idi Amin. He's a ruler with enormous power and influence to annihilate a people group, to annihilate the Jews. And God is in control. God is in control of Mordecai's refusal to bow down that sparked this decree. Whatever you make of Mordecai's refusal, whether he was right or wrong, at this point is irrelevant. But all of that is under the sovereign rule and guidance and decree of God. not just the good things. You know, how bad does it get? Well, it didn't get much worse than this. That they have about a year, about 11 months as it turns out. And within 11 months, their entire race is going to be annihilated. And don't think for one minute that the persons wouldn't have carried out their decree. And yet Mordecai says deliverance will come. It'll come either through you, Esther. So you need to step up to the plate. You'll hear more about that next week. Or it's going to come from some other place. But God is in charge here. God is in control here. His promise can... Do you understand? If you don't believe in the sovereignty of God, you can't believe that God's promises can be fulfilled. You know, you can make a promise, but there's no guarantee that they're going to be fulfilled. You know, that's the problem with open theism, a view that's prevalent today in evangelical circles today. That in order to uphold and maintain some semblance of human autonomy, of free will, the future has to be open. You know, if you've got genuine free will, then the future, you know, if you've got a genuine choice between A and B, well, not even God can know what that choice is if it's a genuine choice. Well, the consequence of saying that the future is open, even if it's only open that much, is that you can never guarantee that any of God's promises are actually going to be fulfilled. Mordecai, can I put it like this? Mordecai was a Calvinist. I mean, he believed that when God made a promise, he's going to fulfill it. And nothing can stand in the way. Nothing. Not human autonomy. Not free will. Not human choices. Not even the wickedness of Haman. You know, how can we believe Romans 8:28 that all things work together for the good of those that love him? All things. You know, not just the good things, not just when everything's going my way. But the wicked things, the evil things, the terrible things, the hurtful things. Can I explain that? No, I can't. I can use words. I can use the trendy word concurrence, which is the trendy word. There is human liberty. We do seem to have choices that we make, and yet God is sovereign. He is sovereign in such a way that he overrules evil without being the author of evil. There's mystery here. And you can read all the books that you can manage in the rest of your life, and there'll still be mystery here. But one thing is for sure. Mordecai believed that there's one truth that can never, ever be tampered with. God is in full and absolute control. Then, as much as now. You know, everyone's all of a dither about what's going on in Washington. I mean, if you listen to CNN, the world's coming to an end. You know, about 10 minutes of it is all I can take. I mean, what's all the hysteria about? I understand the issues, and they're terribly, terribly important issues. I understand that. But, you know, for as Christians, we need to stand back from all of that and say, but God is sovereign. You know, God's purposes will be fulfilled, and maybe this is the way they will be fulfilled. You know, Jesus will come again, and maybe this is the way he comes again. The world will find its way to its end, and God's people, those for whom Jesus died, will be redeemed. That doesn't lessen responsibility, as I keep saying, as Neil is going to tell you next week. Because Esther has to step up to the plate here. It doesn't lessen that responsibility one little bit. You know, she can't say, well, whatever will be. Que sera, sera. No, she has to step up to the plate. And she is forever remembered for having stepped up to the plate. That's your sermon next week, Neil. But tonight, I want us to see this great pastoral truth. The Lord has made everything for its purpose, even the wicked for the day of trouble. Proverbs 16:4. Wow. I mean, it doesn't get bigger than that. The Lord has made everything for its purpose, even the wicked for the day of his trouble. Now that's sovereignty, isn't it? It's saying something about Haman, this wicked man. And God overruled him to accomplish his purpose. To bring about his purpose. You know, that's what Peter said on the day of Pentecost. He pointed to his fellow Jews in Jerusalem. And he said, it was you by wicked hands who took him and slew him. But it was all by the determinate hand, counsel, and foreknowledge of God. You did it and you were responsible for it, but God overruled it all. It was all by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God. And you know, as Christians, we take refuge in that. That no matter what happens, no matter how evil the world gets, no matter how wicked people may seem to prosper for a season, God never abdicates his authority. He will fulfill his purpose to bring glory to himself. Now that's a great pastoral truth that helps us go to sleep at night. You know, you can go home tonight, and when you've had your, whatever it is you have, before you go to bed, your Ovaltine or Horlicks or Bovril or whatever it is that you have before you go to bed, you can get into that bed, pull the covers open. Well, it's too hot for pulling the covers, but you can close your eyes and you can go to sleep and you can know that this universe is in the palms of God's hand and nothing will happen outside of his decree. Let's pray together. Father, we thank you for this extraordinary book of Esther as we just begin tonight to peel away some of its layers. We thank you for this truth that Mordecai believed in. You are sovereign. Your promise to your people will be fulfilled one way or another. You even overrule the wickedness of men in killing your son to bring about our redemption. How great you are. How sovereign you are. We can trust you in every circumstance, in every detail. So help us tonight to know the sleep of the just. And we ask it in Jesus' name.